Diego Maradona. Okay, usually I do a fact file here, but I think we all know who Maradona is. We also all know who Guillem Balague is. He's the author, journalist, and Spanish football expert for Sky, BBC Five Live, so many other places, and he's written a book all about Maradona from the very beginning. So, let's see what the book club thought of it in today's Football Book Club.
This is the part that I don't think has been told properly, that he was the number one, the first one at many things.
When I was crying in front of God, that was a joke. Yeah, I was just having a little gag.
And also you say that Pelé recorded an album for children or something, is that right?
It was with a hand, but, you know, it's England, so...
Hello and welcome to Football Book Club, the only book club where, instead of literary classics, each week we read yet another footballer's autobiography. Less Seamus Heaney, more Troy Deeney.
It's okay. It's
no,
good.
No one has gone for that one. That is you're a tough sell, Jack. You're a very
We're
tough sell.
We're running out.
We are running out of good ones. And thank you anyway, Old Crabtree, for sending that one. That's a good name.
He should have sent that name in instead.
He should have done. I'm James Bug, and over the weeks we'll be reading classics such as Luis Suarez's Crossing the Line, an unsung hero, the biography of Paul Robinson. Not the Spurs one, the other one. But today we have an extra special episode where, for a little change, we're not reading an autobiography. Instead, we're reading master journalist, author, and Spanish football expert Guillem Balague's Maradona, the Boy, the Rebel, the God, with Jack Bernhardt.
Hello.
James Balgen.
Hello.
And welcome to the show, the brilliant Guillem Balague.
Hello, Jack, James. You've got decent names to remember.
Yes. Well, helps. I was thinking
we're all JBs.
When there's more than one people, it helps.
Yeah, we're all JBs. You're a GB. So, yeah, it kind of...
That's it.
Well, that's quite nice.
That's the rule.
That's the rule on the podcast, yeah. That's how it gets.
JB or GBs, that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, only JB GBs. how are you doing today, Guillem? We've had some trouble chatting to you the last few minutes. I gather that your phone might die any second.
Hopefully not, but it was used yesterday extensively, and I forgot to charge it for as long as it was required. And yes, but I think I do a podcast myself, so I know what it's like. The first 15-20 minutes dedicated to just get the sound right and the position, in your case, no video, but the position
15,
of the camera
minutes.
And all those things.
That's 15-20 minutes would be good with us. That'd be like, it's
really
usually 40 minutes.
Going fast, then?
I reckon there's an entire secret podcast we could do, which is just an hour of us going, can you hear me? Is that, okay. What's 10 plus 10? Say what 10 plus 10 is as quick as possible.
That'll be our content.
It'd be fascinating to put together the reactions of everybody else.
Yeah.
Because I bet some struggle and some just get really nervous and, you know, long list of things.
Maybe we should do this as a podcast.
I think it's a good idea. Guillaume, do you remember the former Republic of Ireland goalkeeper, Paddy Kenny?
Yes.
I had to teach him how to install Chrome over the phone so that he could get onto the...
That was good content.
That was good content. That was about half an hour of the recording, I would say.
I did a podcast with a former Real Madrid manager, and having spent almost an hour to try to connect him, and he was abroad and traveling and whatever, when we were going to start the show and do the introduction that you just done, he went like, but it's over, isn't it? Started. So yeah, we've been an hour, haven't we? Yeah, but we haven't recorded anything.
Oh boy.
So
that was the exclusive you wanted, was how well he could put together a
he could connect
but to
I learned
internet.
I've learned something from a photographer. When I wanted to become a photographer a long time ago, I went out with him, and we took pictures, and of course he took really artistic pictures, and I took what I thought were artistic pictures, and then the camera went off on its own. So I was taking pictures of my foot on the floor, of stones, and so I had all the photos together. We print them out, and he goes, rubbish, 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 rubbish. Those are the ones that I thought they were artistic. And he goes like, oh wow, and starts putting together the ones that they were mishit by the camera. And I learned a lesson there. You know, you think that you program is something, but it may just become something else. So I think we should just finish the pod here.
That is a very profound way to finish it on. Usually we end it on with a chant that our mates made up about an old footballer. So that's a much more profound ending to our usual ending to the thing. I'll cut that out and save that for later. You're on because you've written a book, despite being, incredibly busy during the pandemic, I'm sure. You've written a book, and it's amazing. We love it. It's called Maradona, the Boy, the Rebel, the God, as you mentioned. And the level of the research in the book, my word, we've read books where footballers forget things that happen in their own lives. I don't want to name names, but Jermaine Pennant's the one who comes to mind when we read his book. But this, you know, after reading it, I felt like I knew everything about Maradona, everything about Argentina, and also I feel like I might be semi-fluent in Spanish, having read it as well. Because it is great, and we can't wait to chat about it with you. We knew Maradona was fascinating, but even I wasn't really prepared for this book. So, ready, Guillaume?
Ready. Can I say in brackets, and before you move on into what we're doing next?
Please.
It is amazing what you're doing. I think you realize, you must have been told many times, the importance of feedback. Once you publish the book works on its own, is a baby that, you know, goes in its own journey.
Yeah.
And to actually be able to stop for a second and get people that have read it, especially if they liked it, obviously, it really is something that I personally appreciate.
Oh.
So thanks.
Wow.
Thank you.
I didn't think I'd cry this early. That's really nice.
That's not what Darren Huckabee said at all.
That is the opposite of what he said to her. But thank you. We love the book and we can't wait to talk to you about it. So let's go. Okay, so in today's episode, we're going to be talking about the book in more detail. We're going to be stealing tips from you, Guillaume, if that's okay, on just how you write a biography. And we're going to be getting to know our new friend with a few questions at the end. Then we've got a little feature. We've got a little feature idea based on something that you do, Guillaume, on your Twitter. We'll surprise you with a little later. But first, now, the book itself. We're talking almost exactly a year to the day since Maradona passed away, very sadly. I'm going to ask a fairly obvious question to kick things off. Of course, there was renewed fascination in Diego's story when he died. Not that it ever really went away, but you know what I mean. It was everywhere. You've been working on this book for a very long time before that, though, right?
That's right, yeah. I think it's a 2.5 years project, and that's how books work. They give you an idea, you start working on it, you start traveling, and eventually the timing when it comes out is obviously more or less planned too, but you don't know what's going to happen to the person. And in the last fourth of it, when he died, then I have to make it more rounded, if you like. My idea was originally to focus on him as a player, because I thought that all you need to know about Maradona finishes in 2001 when he says goodbye to football in La Bombonera in Boca Juniors Stadium. And having been in a radio show with Dalma Maradona, his daughter, she agreed that after that, I think it's his private life. Yes, it goes wrong, and yes, it multiplies by 20 what you already know of him. So I didn't want to get involved in that at all. But of course, when he dies, the fascinating thing, if that's the word, is that he gets buried by his original girlfriend, wife, who he separated with. And the people that were in the funeral are mostly the people that were important to him when he was a player. So the people that came into his life afterwards, they weren't there. So in any way, that kind of confirmed that all you need to know about Maradona is, kind of finishes in 2001. But I had to, of course, make the story end, as he did too.
Sure. And was the book always scheduled to come out when it did this year? Or was there, didn't have to hurry it up at any point, or you were never said like, oh, it's a good moment for a book? As cynical as that sounds, there was no. Okay.
No, none of that. And in fact, as always, I wish I had had another year or another 6 months. Books never get finished, ever. Mm. And I hate opening up one of my books because I know that I'm going to find in every page something I should have written different, that if I had another chance to add it something else or whatever. But in any case, there was none of that. And in fact, because the pandemic kind of stopped things a little bit, it allowed me to have more time on it during the season, what it would have been a football season than I would normally have. So I normally use the football season to research, to put notes in order, to make certain conversations. And once I got everything, I dedicate the summer to write it, two or 3 months. And then again, when the season starts, you edit it, etc. So here, everything happened a little bit earlier. And I had plenty of time to finish it off. But still, I know that if I open it, I'll find something I didn't like. That's I think that goes with the job.
I think you're right, but still, I mean, reading it, it's so incredibly in depth, and the level of I don't want to fawn over it too much in front of you, but it's like an incredible 300-page essay, and you find out so much, not just about Maradona. But I know, Jack, you were really fascinated by how you learned so much about Argentina during the time as well. And
yeah, I sort of was wondering how much that was, because it's really interesting that you're saying like the story ends in 2001, because you kind of get a potted history of Argentina through Maradona's life. You know, was that just an inevitable thing that happened because Maradona is so tied to Argentina? Or were you sort of thinking you can map Argentina's history through this person's life?
A little bit like that, yes. But if you have a look at other books I've written, it's basically always the same. It's got different layers. You tell the story of the person, but to explain, I don't know, Messi or Cristiano, you have to talk about Argentina or Portugal, or in the case of Cristiano, where he was born in Funchal. With that, you need to explain it to understand better. But then, in the case of Diego as well, politics get mixed with some of his decisions and some of the decisions of the clubs to let him go, and all that also needed context. And the other layer is family. I've always found fascinating to tell the story of these huge people through those that educated them, or those that looked after them or not, as the case may be. And how does it affect their lives? I don't know, from Cristiano, his dad was of course an alcoholic, and since he was very early in his 20s, having been in the Mozambique war, and he was absent, and his mom was absent as well because she had to work. And when that happens, nobody's putting limits to your dreams and to you want to do. So partly his success, the lack of limits, has to do with parents. In the case of Maradona, exactly the same as well. At 15, he becomes the head of the family. So the whole structure of the family gets inverted. Mm-hmm. And he's at the top at 15 with a lot of responsibilities. Mm-hmm. He cannot get it running anymore. He has to keep winning, because if he doesn't keep winning, it affects a lot of people. And without that, you don't get to understand Diego. And a little bit the title is telling you all that. The boy, Diego, always fantasized about going back to, you know, to Villa Fiorito, to his first team, Los Cebollitas, but it was just a fantasy that he had in his head. But he carried that and him as a kid all his life, the rebel, because eventually he became very important and had his own power and authority. And how he used that authority was important to explain the story. That's also not just football.
Mm-hmm.
And then the God talks about Argentina. He was not a God, but he was seen, perceived and created as a God by Argentina. Why? You need to tell the story of Argentina.
There's a bit in the book, sorry, that I've just remembered, that talks about him being a god, where there's a flight that's going on and there's some turbulence and everyone's like, oh, this is dangerous. And then someone gets up and says, don't worry, guys, this plane's not going to crash because God's on the flight. And they point to Diego Maradona and everyone bursts into applause. And it's one of the weirdest stories I think I've ever heard.
It tells you a lot, doesn't it? When a whole nation or people believe that there is a God walking amongst us, you know, why do they think that way? Why do they need to have that such a reference?
Mm-hmm.
And it tells you, you know, about Argentina and how they one day they were told they were going to be the best country in the world, and it hasn't happened. So they need to, on one hand, blame somebody, and that's political crisis after political crisis as a consequence of it. And two, if they have somebody that has conquered the world and has shown that the Argentinians are really special, then they make him even bigger. And that's, of course, Diego and many others.
Absolutely. And he, going back to the religious side, I mean, of course, we know of Maradona through the legends and stuff, but even then, this book is packed with things that I had no idea about. I had no idea there was a church of Maradona. It doesn't surprise me.
That sounds like, very quickly, that sounds like a joke that got out of hand.
Right, like the Jedi thing.
Let's have a Church of Maradona, and then like 10 years down the line, it's a proper religion.
Yeah.
Do you know, I haven't decided yet if it's a joke or not, and I know
Interesting.
Them. I know them very well. So they kind of course, it's a joke. Of course it's a joke, they tell you. But they also tell you the times when they met him and how they fell completely in awe of him, how they cried in front of his eyes, in front of him, how they felt completely like in the presence of a superior being. I'm thinking, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's a joke, this thing that you just created.
It's a bit
confusing.
When I was crying in front of God, that was a joke. Yeah, I was just having a little gag.
We had, I remember, isn't there a thing called dudism, when people dress up as the Big Lebowski? There's a certain day of the year they all walk around in dressing gowns and things. When you're going that far, I think it becomes real. I think it was less of a joke. It's not like just fancy dress. That takes it too far. But also there was, like, I learned that his feet were so wide he didn't tie shoelaces or they'd hurt. I didn't know that about him. He used to count as nutmegs in games, just like he used to count goals, which I can see Dele Alli doing these days. I can see that being a thing that he would do as well.
And that's also, an Argentinian thing, by the way.
Is it? Okay. It
tells you a lot about the culture of Argentina. If a player that has just started his career as a professional counts nutmegs, why is that? And it is because it's a show of art, and it's a show of something attractive for the audience, because that's what a lot of Argentinians play for. They're very, very good professionals, but at the same time, there is this artistic side to them that they really appreciate, and nutmegs is the perfect, you know, the perfect exponent of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just millions of these little things that are littered throughout the book, and you learn so many more things about the kind of the legend of him behind that. I mean, you couldn't really ask for someone with more source material. I don't think you could do this. You couldn't do this book for a lot of people. Like, so no offense, I don't know, Paul Konchesky. You probably struggled to write a book like this around him. However,
give me a chance.
Okay, yeah. Well,
that's a promise. That's a promise right there.
Is that a little sneak preview at your next book, Guillaume? Is it the hidden story of Paul Konchesky?
To be honest, you're writing one thing. Maradona is such a huge personality, and perhaps I didn't even myself realize the magnitude of it, even though he's been a very ever present in my life, really, and imagine in Argentinian people's life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, having been, I was in Barcelona when he was at Barcelona, mm-hmm. And then of course when starts being successful with Napoli, something we all follow, etc.
Yeah.
I had to read 39 books that have been written about Maradona. The thing that has made it successful in outside Argentina and Spain, but funnily enough, also in Argentina, but we'll get into that, mm-hmm. is that there is not so many international books on Maradona, apart from his two biographies, autobiographies.
Yes.
Which is him telling the story, which, you know, as you get, if you read the book, you very quickly get that he's got a very twisted perception of reality.
Sure.
And a lot of it.
Yeah.
And if you want to hear his story, the books are there. But in English, you haven't got much more. There's another book, but was done in the 90s with a very Anglo-Saxon kind of look to the whole thing. So, you know, Diego's a cheat and a drug addict. And
was it written by Peter Shilton?
And this is the content I wanted.
But I tried to make it from a different angle. And that's where actually he has gone really well in Argentina, because he's a foreigner, but who understands Argentina more or less, who's trying to tell them about their God. And I thought, it's like, in Argentina, nobody will want this book. But on the other hand, they just cannot have enough of Diego.
Could I just ask, you talked about writing the book sort of you began the book quite a way before he actually died. Was it ever your intention to spend some time with him before the book come out and sort of get his sort of approach, his opinion on it and sort of like see what he thought about it to confirm things or add to the book in any way?
It's a good question, because yes is the short answer. My idea was to, once I had it done, to go to him with the latest club that he was in, Gimnasia Esgrima, mm-hmm. and then tell him about it. But I also knew two things that worked against that, even though I was certainly going to do it. I was going to hand it over, a copy of the book, to him before it actually going to print. One is that he'd lost it. He's lost it for a long while.
Right.
Pochettino went to see him when Pochettino was left Spurs, and he was in the door of the changing room, literally saying hello to a queue of people that just wanted to be with him and take a selfie before a game, this is. And Pochettino thought, all right, I'll join the queue. And the queue eventually moves. And it's like when Diego sees him kind of out of place, what is Pochettino doing here? I think I know this guy. Oh, it's Pochettino. Poche, he eventually says. And he says to Mauricio, look, tell me where you're sitting. And during the game, I look at you. And if there is something you see from the game, let me know. And I may just correct it down to your observations. And Pochettino felt so sorry about it. He said, look, Diego, I'm going to actually be sitting on the other side of the pitch. You won't be able to see me. So, you know, good luck with the game. And it was a very short conversation for somebody that them two have got a long relationship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You could see then that his head wasn't fully there. Mm. Plus, he had an entourage, which was, as you know, if you're following the stories now, they kind of been blamed or at least investigated for his death. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They thought they were protecting him, and in fact, what they were doing is actually pushing him down into the hole, mm-hmm. And with lawyers, psychologists, psychiatrists, doctors, nurses. So to get to him, it was even hard for his daughters because his number used to be changed by the people that looked after him. So
wow.
They didn't get close. Even his daughters didn't get close to him. They did eventually. But imagine having to go through all that, which would have been a part of the story as well. But it wasn't to be.
So that was against, not Maradona wasn't necessarily aware of this happening, that they were changing his number and things. It was a way of coercion or?
I think there's a mixed answer here. On one hand, he had these people next to him because he wanted them. Mm-hmm. He always wanted people next to him, and he didn't always have the right people next to him. Did he know how bad they were? Possibly not, because otherwise he would have reacted. But when they give you beer in the morning so you don't bother them, your perception of reality, yet again, it gets very, very blurred.
Mm. And that's something which happened throughout his career, really, with the perception of reality changing, especially as he moves on from more one club to the next, kind of especially after Barcelona to Napoli.
Well, when he goes to Napoli, drugs take a big, big relevance in his life. I think, as I explained, the first time he took cocaine was perhaps the last day that he was in Barcelona, the last night.
Mm-hmm.
And like the myth, because there are a lot of myths that have been repeated about Diego, which I haven't been able to confirm, which sounds to me like they were just that myths.
Mm-hmm.
But one that I would like to kill is that he wasn't getting cocaine in Barcelona, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he went to Napoli, it became very, very obvious. And then he mixed that with alcohol, which destroys your brain. And mixed with his addiction and bipolar personality, plus possibly he was chronically depressed as well. So there's a lot of things that didn't help him see reality properly. So a lot of the time, he just basically had to create his own reality, or either get away from it or imagine another perfect reality when he was a kid. Or just go through with whatever drug there was near at the time.
And obviously, that's awful. It's the side of Maradona that we all know he was cursed by. However, at the same time, some of the book's more, the more memorable moments, the more memorable moments of his life are obviously when he's influenced by a lot of these things. And so you can't really tell, as you say in the book, you can't tell the legend of Maradona without going into these things. And I know, Jack, you were very interested by a lot of the his branding and how all the TV shows and stuff they made around him and all these things.
Yeah, it seems like he was sort of, from your description of him, he sort of seems to be the first modern footballer in the sense that he knows how he has to be able to brand himself. He seems to have his own like TV shows, and that's a really big part of his like legend, because I don't think I'd quite realized how short his career in Europe was at the very height, especially compared to, if you look at Messi and Ronaldo now. How much was that branding so important to him, do you think?
This is the part that I don't think has been told properly, that he was the number one, the first one at many things. And you go back and he had a press officer like nobody else did.
Mm-hmm.
He had a physical coach, his own physical coach, which everybody does now, but not everybody actually, funnily enough, they should, but not everybody has it, but a lot of players do.
Yeah.
He was the first to push a trade union for players when players didn't even know they had rights.
Mm.
And he was the first one to tell us that UEFA and FIFA were corrupt, and we thought he was crazy. I remember that perfectly. Ah, no, Maradona is just crazy. And look at what's happened since.
Sure.
And yes, he was the first one to believe that the star system that you saw in Hollywood with actors and musicians, he a footballer can do that. And that was a mixture of him wanting to be treated like a star, needing to be treated like a star, him seeing the potential, and his agent, his first agent, Jorge Sister Pille, to actually also share that vision.
Mm-hmm.
So they did crazy things like started their own production company.
Yep.
Or their own company related to Diego, Maradona Productions, which then went out there and got commercial deals, some terrible deals that they did. They sold themselves really badly. But,
yeah.
But in any case, it was a completely new era. And also they filmed a lot. They had a cameraman with them, partly in Barcelona, but mostly in Napoli. And that from those 500 hours of filming that that are available, that's where Asif Kapadia got his brilliant documentary on Maradona.
He could have
chose, you could have done another movie or 10.
Yeah.
Did you have you trawled through all that material?
No. Not all of it.
I've
seen some of it. But it's somebody can dedicate their time to it and do it. Yeah, as I say, another movie. They of course went to United States where they thought that they could sell that. Look, best play in the world, you know, Napoli winning things and World Cup and we're inside. Nobody bought it. Nobody bought it.
Wow.
Netflix was not out there yet.
It's a shame social media didn't exist. It'd have been a.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see there being pros and cons to social media existing.
I was
going to
say.
There's probably. I mean, obviously, it was around for some of his life, but for his playing career, perhaps. But, you know.
Yeah. I don't know if you follow his Instagram in the last few years, months. And I don't know if it's been deleted, but it's. It just tells you a little bit of what situation he was in.
Right.
I've only seen him at Salt Bae's restaurant.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Where he's looking really impressed at some salt being put on his steak.
I think he was the first with that. Because I think he was the first footballer that I saw at Salt Bae's restaurant. And now they're all doing it. I saw Brian Hill was in it the other day. I saw Reguilón was there. I'm a Spurs fan. Yeah, just in case. I'm not just naming, you know, fringe Spanish players. These are the ones whose Instagrams I follow. Anyway, as it is. And
has Konchesky been?
I don't know if Paul Konchesky's been, but we'll find out in Guillaume's book when it comes out. I'm sure whether he went there.
By the way, you may be losing me because he says my phone is overheating.
This is so exciting.
So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It's going to explode, but I don't think you're going to be able to watch that.
So, we had a little bit of a problem there.
It exploded.
Yeah. You warned us it might happen. Your phone might explode, and it did. So you're a man of your word.
We were joking. We were having a great time. Wouldn't it be really funny if Guillaume Balaguer's phone exploded, and then suddenly it happened?
It did.
And for a while it was more terrifying than funny. We were very concerned that was the end of the interview, and then we were going to have to answer. We'll get James to answer our questions about Maradona, but never mind. Yeah. It's all good. It's all solved. It's all great. We're back. Guillaume's on his iPad. Perfect. But if the audio has changed a little bit, guys, that is why. Just in case anyone's a little bit concerned, go, well, where's it sound? That's why. I think we should talk about enemies and friends, which is something that pops up a lot in Maradona's book. James, I know this is something that fascinated you throughout.
So obviously he was a complex character, with like many adoring him and then others seeing him as an enemy in a lot of ways. But he wasn't one to let things go. He always seemed to have a point to prove or had the idea of revenge in his mind when he'd felt previously wronged. So the theme of revenge does crop up quite a bit in the book. You know, not being selected for the 78 World Cup when he was 17, obviously bringing down England so dramatically in 86. And as you mentioned, outing FIFA as being corrupt and UEFA. So he seemed very determined to take a stance, didn't he?
Yeah, he came out of his district or of his quarters in Via Fiorito, determined to challenge everyone that stand on the way. And to do that, you have to have a very clear idea of what's right and what's wrong. And in his mind, he did. I don't think he always got it right, but certainly he wasn't scared of challenging whoever, you know, calling the Pope and saying, you know, all these things that you've got in the Vatican, all this gold. If it was sold, you cure the poverty in the world.
Yeah,
he didn't care. And you know what? I do miss people like that. We're so PR conscious these days, and he, as I said, he sometimes got it wrong, and of course you couldn't challenge him. He lived in a world in which he was always right. But at the same time, when he likes to break and destroy the myth of Pelé in front of Pelé, or when he actually just tries to tell politicians that they're doing the job wrong, it's a breath of fresh air. And nobody does that anymore.
That's
maybe Marcus Rashford in a way.
Yeah, true. And the Pelé stuff is particularly fascinating because at the beginning they have there's a few meetings with Pelé in the book. There's the first one, I think the first one where Pelé tracks him down when he's still a young player, and they have this meeting, finally get together and they talk to each other.
When Pelé ends up playing the guitar and singing.
That's
the
right.
First one.
And also you say that Pelé recorded an album for children or something. Is that right? Did Pelé record an album?
It's true.
That is bizarre.
It's out there. It hasn't been digitalized. But it's out there, yes.
We're tracking that.
Is there a reason it hasn't been digitalized? Is it?
No, it tends to be with rights, I imagine, because sure. it's the kind of thing that it will sell well, even as a brick thing.
Yeah. I'll be streaming that on Spotify. But the next time, I think Pelé criticised him at the 86 World Cup. Is that right? And then...
what happens is what normally happens with those that cannot get it wrong anymore and that kind of miss a chance anymore, which is that they defending their own space. So Pelé, when Maradona was peaking, make sure that put a lot of question marks, you know, to be the best, he's got to show it, and he's got to show it constantly and every time, because if he doesn't show it one day, I'll just catch him and I'll tell everyone that he's not doing well. And that's a little bit what Pelé did. And of course, Maradona was very aware of that. By the way, Maradona does that to Messi, for instance. Sure. It's just what happens.
Sure.
It was a source of motivation for Maradona. But at the same time, once they both retired, it was quite funny to see that battle between both of them to see, you know, who was the best in the world. It's like, leave it. You know, we want both of you to be remembered as great. Isn't that enough for them? It wasn't.
There's a hilarious set piece in the book where they're at an award ceremony and one of them, neither will go down an elevator to be on the same floor as the other one until the other one does it first. So they're just sat waiting for ages and the whole thing, which would make a genuine...
Are they like, everyone's really hungry. They just want to get on with this. You have to just get down this elevator, please.
And at the end, Maradona's getting the award right and he gives it to Pelé and then Pelé's like, I don't know what to do with it. Something like that. It's like, you take it back. It's really funny.
Genius.
It is. But I think that the enemy that crops up the most in the book and has the most space devoted to it in there is England and the England national team, to be specific, even though, you know, England, you know, with the Falklands and everything, does pop up quite a few times in there. However, England national team, you devote three chapters to the World Cup quarterfinal in 86. And it's brilliant. You have a chapter devoted on the first half, second half, and then the post-match reactions, basically. And you go through all the players and the team and say how they were reacting to it. And I think is it poor Steve Hodge who gets Steve Hodge who has his who takes Maradona's shirt and doesn't realize that Maradona's handed the ball. He's like, oh, look, lads, I've got his shirt.
They're like, shut up, Steve.
yeah, but it's brilliant. It's really. Obviously, it's to an English audience, it's Maradona's most famous moment over here. But there's so much of it, again, that I didn't know about. And it really, as good as a book as I've ever read, really, for it. It really hones you in on that moment and you really feel like you're going through it kind of beat by beat.
Yeah, what's interesting is that Maradona won that game. And of course, he did those two goals. So he doesn't look back at that game as a pivotal moment. It is in many, many ways. But I made it longer because of the audience, because of course Orion is my publishers, and and they are, you know, Anglo-Saxon based, and I wanted to tell you what happened on that game, but then it helps to then understand the whole picture, how the myth gets created, how they years later look back at that game, and that was used to explain that, yes, of course he's a god. Look what he did. But it also, he's got so many, yet again, so many ways to read what happened there from the hand of God, you know, what's behind it culturally. I had to somehow put there what Fernando Signorini, his first physical coach, said to him, if you hadn't done it, you could have scored two goals in some other way. And by the way, you would have saved a lot of time to sociologists and psychologists and historians of the game, because they're still trying to justify it. But no, Maradona felt, look, I'm the rebel. I just beat the rich guys, the guys that went to war with, etc. So fit the image that he had of himself. And how he related to the world.
And it seems like when there's a bit of a split, I think you mentioned, in Argentina about whether deception should be a part of the game or not. But however, there's a great line. We've just read all four of Michael Owen's books. And there's a line about him in the book from, I'm going to butcher the pronunciation. I'm very sorry, Guillaume. Ezequiel Fernandez Mores. Is that correct?
Moors. No, the Moors is like an English.
It is the Anglicized version. English, yeah. Oh, okay, sure, fine. So he's an Argentinian journalist. He talks about he talks about Owen's dive in France 98. He says, "Did we say that here in Argentina, Owen was representing the pirates, English villainy, the greed of Francis Drake and company? No, we didn't say that here. We consider mischief to be a natural part of football, a game of rogues," which that is the best description of anything to do with Michael Owen, better than everything in the four books that we read. So it's
a game of rogues is not how I describe Michael Owen at all. Ah, the old roguish Michael Owen.
But I know in the book you talk about how not everyone necessarily agrees with whether it's right or it's wrong the way through it, but Maradona doesn't care, really, does he? He's, he won the game, shrugs it off.
No, doesn't care, but at the same time he uses it. He uses it to fill his that myth that eventually gets created, and obviously allows him to say that he was invited by Peter Shilton. No, he was not invited by Peter Shilton to his homage, and why would he go to a homage of a goalkeeper anyway?
It's really funny. Yeah.
I mean, it's a good point, really. It is a very good point. I don't get to go to Peter Shilton's party.
As Spurs fans still to this day talk about, though, he did go to Ozzy Ardiles' testimonial on Play for Spurs, which was very famous.
He did. On that, by the way, on that game, and on his death, I don't know why somebody sent me a tweet that I put out when he died in reference to the covers of the English newspapers.
Sure.
How they still were talking on the day of his death about that goal. And it's like, leave it. I mean, he was so much more. Obviously, again, tabloids create myths and create stories. And for them, he will always be the villain. But on his death, I mean, it was a bit crass, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I agree.
I think it's such a part of English footballing history, in a negative way, where it's like, we've got to find the villain who's the villain in our history, and I think that's why people can't get.
Yeah, Jack. But I mentioned that tweet actually. No, I know you don't agree, but just to those that think that's worthwhile, just perpetuating this idea that England or English people think that way. I asked the 25 coaches that I had at Biggleswick United, the club I'm chairman of, to give me in one word what Maradona was to them. And these are mostly 30 to 40 year olds. And not one said shit. Mm. Not one. Mm. It was genius, magnificent, magical, talented, not cheap. So I think maybe that narrative should be moved on a little bit.
I agree.
You know, tabloids are always good to remind us of our failings in the past.
Tabloids absolutely love to create that narrative.
We've got enough enemies of our own. We've made enough, you know, we've got enough players of our own who've cocked things up for us in the past. We haven't got to blame, Maradona.
Blame Maradona.
Yeah.
Also, like the fact that you're right, reducing the greatest player of all time to being like, his hand, that's it.
Yeah.
The thing I find that's fascinating about that you talk about in the book is the way that he had apparently practiced it, or that he was like, it's a conscious thing, which is really fascinating. And also, like, in not old football, but in football before replays, it like completely makes sense. Like, obviously you would put your hand up and head at the same time and be like, I scored a header. Why wouldn't you? It's really smart.
More than, obviously he does it in training. If he doesn't reach there, he will do it. And that it's instinctively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But instincts come from education and from the way you think about, again, yourself, about the game, about the rival, about all that. And it does tell you about Argentina, and it does tell you about Latin culture. Mm-hmm. If you can get away, and my culture too, if you can get away with it, do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get caught, sorry, mate. I mean, you knew it was wrong. But if you can get away with it, that's something that is, I think it shortens our, goodness for sure, but certainly it makes those that want to cheat have a longer life than they should.
Mm-hmm.
That should be eradicated from our culture, but it isn't. It isn't. It happens with tax. It happens with stealing from others. It happens from a lot of things that again, the hand of God helps perpetuate and is wrong and absolutely wrong.
It's crazy that probably the two things that Maradona's most associated with, or most famous for, across, like, universally, happened in the same game. It's just
within a space of like a few minutes.
It's mad. See, this negative thing that's still remembered now by the British mainly, this sort of cheat moment, but then what was also dubbed the greatest goal of the century.
Yeah,
it's crazy that happened in the same game. It's just mad. It's mad to me.
And in that pitch. And I wasn't aware of that, because of course we watched it on the television. I never looked at it in detail. and then Gary Lineker, but everybody else told me the pitch was a potato field. It was terrible. And yet he could manage to come out with something like that. Yeah. Plus they realized, didn't they, Glenn Hoddle, I think he was. Was it Hoddle? No, there was a foul before the beginning of his run with the ball. That could have been given. That could have been given. And I found it. I found that the take of the referee magnificent, because as we heard Mark Clattenburg recently, the referees have got such a huge influence on games. They decide what kind of game it's going to be. They decide not only a foul, but if it's going to be a place where fouls are allowed, or where, you know, art is allowed, as it happened in this case. Because he was there was two or three fouls on the way to him finishing that magnificent goal. So another referee, a Spanish referee, would have said, foul, that's it, end of the move. And he would have just, you know, stopped us having that brilliant moment. So we have to thank the referee for the moment too.
I feel like you'd just get mesmerized by it, wouldn't you? If you were watching it as a referee, you'd just be like, oh, okay, just keep going.
In fact, he did.
Yeah, he did.
Because it's like I'm looking at something that I haven't seen and I haven't been part of before. He felt like that.
And they became friends afterwards in a way. He came to visit him, didn't he, I think? And he was presented with...
In Tunisia.
In Tunisia.
Presented him with a picture of them in that game. And football does that. There's so many enemies that become friends. I mean, for Xavi Alonso to be managed by Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola in his career, it's one of those that you think, it will never happen, but it does. Cesc Fabregas with both of them as well. But it's one thing is what we create and how we portray it and what happens behind the scenes. They're just professionals, aren't they? And they realize how hard it is and how much in common they've got with even their best rivals.
Absolutely. And this moves us on to one of the last things we want to say about the book, which we've moved on to friends now. So we know about, you know, his relationship with some fairly dodgy forces in Naples. But one relationship I knew nothing about at all was how chummy he was with Fidel Castro. This is something which blew my mind. Castro went to his wedding.
Was invited to his wedding.
He didn't go to the wedding, sorry.
He didn't make it. And yes, Fidel suggested that when he was going through a period of recuperation, rehabilitation from his addictions, to come to Cuba. And he did that. And of course, if you follow the story right now, let's say that in Cuba, he didn't just rehabilitate.
Yes.
He also created a lot of kits. And some of them kept DNA of Maradona. So in the near future, if there is more kids that want to be named and recognized as Maradona's kids, there is the possibility of doing that scientifically too, because he had a lot of female friends in that time.
Sure. Is this the same when he went to Cuba? Was this when he had the audience with Castro? Was that before? Because there's a moment where I think my favorite part of the book, when Fidel Castro meets Maradona, and he's obsessed by asking him how you take a penalty, so much so that he's taking notes whilst asking Maradona. And then as Maradona leaves in the car, Castro kind of chases after the car and says, wait, what was it you said about the penalties again? Something like that. The image of Castro.
When you are the head of a nation, you never know when you have to take a penalty. So I think he just was preparing himself.
Exactly. I mean, if only Diana Ross had asked Diego Maradona before taking that penalty at the World Cup 94.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Good point.
That's a very good point. Or she'd ask Fidel Castro.
Fidel Castro watching at the time being like, oh no, don't do it like that.
Diego's advice. And there'll be more from Guillaume after the break as we find out just how we too can write a footballer's biography. See you then. Hi, we're Football Book Club Podcast. And we need your support now. Let's drop the appeal music. Hi, everyone. James here, and I just want to tell you about the brand new Football Book Club Club, which you can join to receive bonus weekly episodes, access to exclusive member events, and your very own Football Book Club book bookmark, all for the same price as a used copy of Darren Huckabee's 2007 book, Hux. So if you enjoy the podcast and need to hear more afterwards, head to patreon.com/footballbookclub. Enjoy the episode. Now, Guillaume, you've written books about Ronaldo, Pochettino, Messi, and of course Maradona, as we're talking about today. And when we say books, we mean extremely thorough historical essays. Do you read many footballers' autobiographies yourself?
No.
Okay.
No, no. No, because I know how they work. I know how they do them.
Sure.
Because well, we've got some recommendations. So,
I bet you do. By the sound of it already, I know you do for sure. No, I read a lot of literature. And I think for those that have followed me from the beginning, from A Season on the Brink about Liverpool to now, mm-hmm. I think they may realize that I'm adding more and more literature to it because I will love at some point to write fiction.
Yes.
And even, for instance, in the first book, there was a chapter I had to negotiate with my agent, with the translator, and because they're like, but this is not possible, which is chapter 8, in which I only had quotes of people as if they were sitting around a table talking about halftime in Istanbul in the Champions League final.
Yes.
And I did it in a kind of dynamic way, so it looks like people are interrupting each other. So I create the fiction without saying it, that they're all together telling that story. There was a little bit of literature there, but as I progress, not to get bored myself of the same story of, you know, kid comes from difficult background and becomes the best in the world, I add literature. But interestingly enough, I'm not sure Orion will mind. I hope they don't mind me saying this, but
we can always cut it.
Yeah, you can always cut it. I'm actually, when I'm writing, I'm doing two books, and that's why it takes even longer to do, because I write in Spanish because I had a really bad experience of the Pep Guardiola book when it was translated. I wrote it in English, was translated into Spanish. It was really, really bad. So I had to rewrite it for 2 months. Ugh. So then I thought, okay, and another way of doing it is I write it in Spanish. I've got my own translator who we work together. Then I edit the English version. But when you start editing a book, it grows in a different way. Mm. So it's like having twins.
Interesting.
The Spanish version goes to Argentina, goes to Spain, and of course goes through his own editorial process. But the English version went 20,000 words beyond the plan. And the English version is the one that's being translated into, at the moment, 12 languages. Mm-hmm. And by contract, you have to do 120,000 words. That's what they told me. And I did 20,000 more. So I had to take 20,000 words of the English version compared to the Spanish version, which is exactly as I wrote it. I thought, this is too hard to me. So I thought to the publishers, just suggest something for me to take out, something that doesn't work in English. And funnily enough, the most literary part of the book that are in Spanish and not in English, because it doesn't fully work.
Ah.
I did a little bit of magic realism, an homage to Cortázar, to Borges, that didn't fully work. I can tell you the story because Juan Funes was a player that was in the national side with Argentina. And at 29, he developed a heart problem and he was in hospital for a long time. And while he was in hospital, he had a dream and told his wife, I need to see Diego. He was in hospital, didn't even know if he was going to come out of hospital. I want to see Diego because I dreamt that he was going to buy me a car, a Mercedes. And I want to talk to him. So Diego gets told, knows that he's ill, goes to hospital, grabs his hand, and Juan tells Diego, the car was red, it's a Mercedes. And Diego says, don't worry, Juan, I've heard about it. I've already talked to somebody. When you come out of hospital, you will have your red Mercedes. And as he was saying that, Juan dies as Diego's holding his hand. So the story's been told from Juan, even from the beginning, even after, because he says at that point, and I died there. And wasn't it great that Diego got everybody together and did a homage to me, where obviously my family was present and raised money for my family to pay for the hospital bills. And now they've got a street in my name. And I think Diego came to see me in the cemetery once. And that's a story. That's one chapter. Oh. That read in English didn't fully work. That was taken out of the book. And I think it doesn't work because you are too logical. Hence, you created the Industrial Revolution instead of magic realism.
Right.
And in English, doesn't fully work. And I understand that. So we took that and a couple of things more of that caliber. So it's like two different books in a way.
Wow,
so,
that's
so interesting.
It really is.
Yeah.
Oh, what a shame.
God, if only we weren't so logical. You made us sound like automatons.
we're so boring. Well,
this cannot work. This did not happen, Guillaume.
I hope they don't mind me saying this story.
No,
because I was very proud of it and the way I wrote it, and everyone was very, very proud of it. But I think it works better in Spanish.
I mean, you do love chucking in quite a lot of classical allusions and stuff throughout the book, which again is something which we're not particularly used to. No offense, like. I know Gary Monk, he didn't pop too many of those in, but that's not his fault.
That would have been an amazing twist in Gary Monk's book.
Yeah.
It was like...
Talking about the classics.
Yeah.
Turns out I had died 20 years previous to this FAW meeting.
It's interesting you go back to the idea of having written too much at the same time, because that is something I wanted to ask. But also, we spoke to Tom Fordyce, who tends to ghost writes a lot of autobiographies of footballers. But I wanted to know how you go. He told us how he went from beginning to end. He sits down with the player and does it, unlike the Maradona, obviously, which was a bit different. But how do you usually do it? What if you can talk us through in a simplified beat-by-beat way of how you write a book from the beginning, I'd love to hear.
Let me say that I've been invited to do an autobiography for the first time, and I'm thinking about it. I'm putting one condition, because it's an amazing story for one of the top players of our lifetime. But I said, only if he tells me the truth. So we're kind of negotiating that. If he tells me the truth, yes. And obviously they have to fully approve that they're happy with me, but they got good references and it may happen. But if it does happen, you know, I cannot tell you now, but you'll know this. This is what I made reference to.
We'll have the Paul Konchesky story.
Yeah. please, Paul Konchesky, tell him the truth. Just be honest.
Yeah. How I do it, basically, I'm a storyteller. So I need stories, and I need enough ingredients and enough stories to actually tell the bigger story.
Yeah.
And it's about research. It's about going to places. It's about talking to people that were close to them, talking to them, or using the time that we've been together also that helps, with Messi, with Ronaldo, with Rafa Benitez on the Liverpool book, with Pep Guardiola. We had moments in private, in public. There were interviews face to face as well. And then, because I've got this fear of being found out. I don't know if he's got a name now, but you know, that fear that many seem to have. And I thought I was on my own, but I overwork, I overproduce, I over research. And when I eventually get down to writing, and I realize that, you know, every chapter has got 80 pages of research and has to be converted into 10 pages or 6 pages or whatever, it's like, all right, breathe deeply and let's go for it. But it's just, there's no other secret from me, because I don't think I'm a talented writer, but I think I can tell a story based on a lot of research, and that's why I like to put together things that I say that I find out, but others that tell me too and help me find out and explain the person that we're dealing with.
I think Jack's gonna say the same thing I was.
You're a very good writer.
You're a very talented writer, Guillaume. Yeah, you don't want
you're very talented.
There's a bit in this book.
I'm not fishing for compliments.
I know, you were.
There's a bit in this book that made me laugh out loud that I've just remembered, where you're talking about the commentary for Maradona's second goal against England, and it's this amazing bit of commentary. It's sort of like, this is incredible. What's going on? He's like a little kite soaring through the sky. Yeah, this is amazing. Yeah. I love it. And then at the very end of the paragraph you just wrote, little kite. It really made me laugh. I was like, what was that? It's very funny.
Yeah, it's a very famous commentary. Very famous commentary from a very, very, very famous commentator that he felt mixed feelings about what was going on. That's the good goal. That's the good goal. No, he described that really, really well. But the other one, the hand of God, it was with a hand. But, you know, it's England, so...
It's fair enough.
More or less his commentary.
Wow.
It's fair.
So the bulk of your writing is editing, really. It's turning or turning these notes into the story.
Obviously, the most enjoyable part is once you've got the notes in order, and I've got people, I've got Maribel Russo, my right-hand man, woman, and I just keep sending her stuff that I read or that I thought or lines that I want to put in.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the amount of stuff. It just goes that way, and interviews, and she transcribes them, etc. And then she puts them in order, in the order that I've decided the structure of the book to be. And then, as I said, you know, I've got 60, 80 pages, whatever. I have to convert them to 6 or 7. But the first part is, okay, let's stop. Let's just, I know all this that's coming, and I know I have everything I need to say, and it's all there, but what am I saying? And then that, you know, go for walks, and there's a key moment where just you find, right, I got it. This is what I want to say. And then you start writing, and then you start bringing the notes in, always thinking that you have to entertain the reader. It's not just a mathematic thing. So you put these notes together, people will read it. No, it has to be entertaining, and it has to entertain me first. So that's a little bit the process. Not the usual process, I don't think, but anyway, it works for me.
And the traveling side is fascinating as well, because, like you say, and as you mentioned a lot in the book, you do go to the places, which I don't know if that's a very common thing with that, but it definitely brings everything to life massively.
It should be, because it absolutely does bring things to life. And what I do, because I don't have a job. My life is a holiday, and what I tend to do is when I do those things, I 2 weeks in Argentina, let's go. Let's do it for New Year's Eve. William, Maribel, Brent, Tony, just come with me. All right, let's go. And you just go on holidays. And, you know, a lot of the time that means that they have a great time while I'm just having to go for interviews or whatever. But we do that together. The first one I did that was for the Liverpool book. I basically was called like at 7 o'clock in the morning in Istanbul the day after the final. And I had just gone to bed, having been going out with, you know, with Xabi Alonso's family. And it was a really, really special night, obviously, Liverpool fan that I am.
Yeah.
But then 7 o'clock in the morning, right, we need to do this book, and it has to come out, like, you have to have the draft by August and put it in May. I thought, okay, well, let's do the interviews over the phone, because everybody will go on holidays at the end of the season, obviously, which I did. And then thought, I'm going to hire a house in Mallorca with a pool. I'm going to invite my family and friends, and they're just going to come over. And what I'll do, and I haven't done this since, but what I'll do is I'll get up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, just to have lunch with them and have the afternoon with them, go to the pool and then go to the beach and then go for a bit of a night out. And midnight, I leave them on their own, and then I work for 7 hours, go to bed, wake up at 1 p.m. It kind of killed me, but it's really good fun. So I mixed holidays with business, because that is my holidays. I work 24/7. So I really have fun with that. And anyway, when we went to Argentina, when we went to Napoli, I did not go on my own. I went for fun too.
So you're kind of writing a book is a very fun experience, it sounds like. I mean, that sounds like hell getting the notes down to some of my pages. But, you know, if you get to do it in a via.
I get ill every single time. So it's not fun. I enjoy it, and it's a part of my career that I didn't know it was going to take off. We all think we had a book in ourselves, but you know, I don't know, what is it now, 6, 7, 8, I can't remember now, because I include the ebooks as well that nobody's read, 2 of them. So I get so much into it, and I don't know how to do things half-heartedly. I get ill every single time. And generally tends to be at the end of it. So when it's all more or less done, which is good, because it takes me 2 or 3 days to recover from that.
In which case, we won't try and pitch to you to write our book about our fictional footballer, Andy Crabb. I feel like that could be a step too far.
That will end you.
Having to do a story about a person who doesn't exist in the first place, that might be too hard.
Oh, I heard there's a big story, yes.
He's a real, you're missing out.
Had quite a storied career.
I'm going to really quickly move us on to our last segment. Guillaume, you have a segment on your social media called Coffee with Guillaume. We've got a little feature we're going to bring you, just to ask you a few questions, called Tea with JB. So we're all the JBs, and that good name, guys? You happy with that name? That's not too great.
Fine. We should call it, what was the guy who sent in the question? Or they sent in the... It's like Old Mad
Old Crabtree. Old Crabtree.
Old Crabtree.
Okay. Tea with Old Crabtree. We have a few little questions. We've only got a couple of minutes, so we'll try and run through these quickly. Spurs fan, cards at the table, as I mentioned. You and Poch are pretty tight. Was he ever close to coming back this summer? Ooh. I like that giggle.
He's under contract.
Ooh. A lawyer's response. Where's your magical realism now, Guillaume?
So that means a bit?
Whatever you want it to mean, James.
Whatever you want to mean, okay.
You can't push it.
I can't push it. But you know, I'll take some comfort from what I interpret that as. So, I'm happy now. We've got Conte, which is nice. But it's very exciting. I mean, you must have had an incredibly busy summer, Guillaume, with so many players you wrote books about. Like Ronaldo's on the move, Messi was on the move, Poch wasn't.
Rafa.
On the contract. Rafa, yeah, of course. You must have been asked to do so. Are you tired out from having to do that?
One thing that my brain has helped me to develop my career is that I don't remember things. So if you tell me I was busy, I probably was, which is good because, I remember one thing that I was on my way. I was driving. I flew to London and Manchester, I think. And I was driving to Edinburgh because I always get lost in the fringe.
Yep.
I always have 6-7 days. I've got a little dream of one day, you know, have my own play there and maybe one day. But
if you need help with like a comedy routine or like flyering, like we've
do
all
you know
done.
Someone, Jack?
Yeah, yeah. Oh no. Hey, come on.
I'm putting this down.
Sorry,
we could do a double act together. Oh, that'd be so good.
Podcast guys will just help me with the French play. Okay,
you send us your notes, we'll turn it into the play. Yeah, that's what we'll do.
And then it was like, I need to go to Paris because it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's like, but this is my week where I need to go to Paris. So I had to cancel hotel and everything. I drove to Paris. And it was a good idea to do because I had the chance to speak to Leo and in a kind of 5-minute slot that we were given. But because I kind of went a different angle and talked to him about, you know, if he this reminded him of his first move from Argentina to Spain and then about his kids and everything, it kind of went viral and probably will go into the CBS documentary that we're doing as the second one after I worked for CBS about the Champions League. So
right.
All in all, you do things, you don't know why you're doing them, but it came out really good on that occasion.
Amazing. I'm glad that you've had a moment, though, even though you might not remember it. It sounds like you have been very busy, so it's good that you've had a moment to sit down.
But think of the fringe shows you could have seen instead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's so much better.
I know.
A few questions from other people. We had a lot of people ask about Biggleswedge United, who you mentioned earlier. We had Matthew Brazier, Follow the Trawler, sent some questions about that. Follow the Trawler said, this is going to be a tough question to answer, but what gives you more joy, writing, being a pundit, or being chairman?
Chairman.
Ah.
Okay. No doubt.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And it comes on the back of we lost 18 games in a row. We just go on our first game of the season last weekend. That's the men's first team. The ladies are doing really, really well. And it's been a very, very tough year because the FA moved the men's first team from leagues. So, you know, the popular players all left, all of them. And this is on the back of 2 years where we're about to be promoted, but COVID stopped the league. So that made life very, very hard and very difficult. But then you look at the ladies and they're progressing really well. And this is a project that we started not so long ago, 4 years ago. Plus the youth, the academy also kind of establishing itself as a good place to for kids to come in. And, you know, the volunteers keep growing. We've got a media department. We were in Sky Sports News today for a 4.5-minute slot. We had Gary Cottrell coming over to our ground, the Kitch Hospice Care Stadium. And we were introducing our latest signing, which is Ansu Fati's brother, Brahim Fati, who 24-year-old, who rescinded his contract with Barcelona 2 months ago to come over and stay a year with us. And that's the kind of club it is. I mean, I feel a sense, correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of what's happening in Britain now is about closing doors and not opening them. And in our very, very, very tiny little way, this is a place where everybody's welcome. And that means everyone. So we, you know, women's football has to grow and has to be protected and looked after. People that want to come over as coaches, because we had in the period that I've been at the club since 2014, we had Spanish coaches, Italian, South African, from the United States, players of all kinds as well. That's what the club is about. Is inclusive. We also had Dave Nash, the number one graffiti artist in the UK,
okay,
who is local, and he was doing a mural of Marcus Rashford, and And Emma Hayes, who I found out is the first one that is, and she was very humble and happy that we did that, because also they're role models, aren't they? But
yeah,
they represent also what we're trying to do. And that is so rewarding when you have an idea what you want to do, and then people embrace it and feed from it and help it grow. There is nothing like it. There is nothing like it. And of course, results have been bad. As I said, all the players left apart from one, George Harlow, who I love. Thank you, George. Everybody else left.
Yeah.
But guess what? Six of them are coming back, and that will be our six best players of last season, because they changed the WhatsApp group from "let's go to Kempston" or whatever they were going to, let's say, Biggleswade United.
Oh,
so
wow.
It is amazing. Honestly, it's really, really, because I was talking to one of them, the striker, Charlie Clayton. I said, well, why did you come back? Oh, we couldn't get Biggleswade United going down. As you can imagine, in the table, we had, I think it was 14 games, 0 points. And we lost 10-1, 9-3, because we started using under-18s and under-23s and players that weren't good enough, but they were the only ones we had, because we appealed. The season started almost as we heard the appeal, etc. It's been really tough. But they're coming back. So, you know, football at that level, it's not just about winning and it's not just about money. So it was very, very good to see.
Well, we spoke to Spencer Owen of Hashtag United a while ago, last year, wasn't that, guys? I think we spoke to him, and he similarly...
Who can tell anymore?
Who can tell anymore, at some point during the pandemic. And it's similarly so passionate about it. And it is really great to see that this level of enthusiasm. And I guess, is it less stressful than the writing the book side of things?
No, I deal well with stress. I don't mind it. It's a motivator. It's a good, petrol. And this is, I mean, I've seen people crying, in the last few months, crying and stressful and unable to sleep and unable to eat, that kind of thing, honestly, because once you're involved, it's the biggest thing. It is the biggest thing. But for me, it's not just the result of the weekend, it's the whole picture. And I look at the, as I said, the amount of volunteers are growing and more people coming to the ground, and Dave Nash does a mural for us, and Brahim Afati comes and joins us, and Sky Sports News comes in, and I'm just, wow. But
yeah,
I'm telling you, to the three of you, if you had 2 hours of your week, just 2 hours of your week, and you have a local club, give them 2 hours of your week, and it will come back with much more than you'll give them, I assure you.
Jack, I think your local club is Tottenham, actually, isn't it? I'm pretty sure. Even as an Arsenal fan, I'm pretty sure they're the closest club to where you are.
Yeah.
I know. I hate Chelmsford City for life. They're my boys. You're part of Tottenham. But yeah, carrying on with some of the questions, we had a couple. South Sandrew asked, would you ever write a book on Marcelo Bielsa? He was interested by. And then he also asked a second prong question after that, which was, can Xavi emulate what Pep has done at Barcelona, being part of that DNA? So one a bit more contemporary, one more a possibility.
On Xavi, no, he won't emulate it, because it's impossible to copy the best team in the world ever.
Yeah,
and a team that changed history.
Yeah,
but I think he's got good foundations to be a coach that will bring success to Barcelona in the medium term. Let's not expect too much too early. In the case of Bielsa, I had the plan to do a Bielsa book, and then I realized that somebody else was doing a Bielsa book, and he's much better placed. He lives there, and he has come out really, really good as well. So I said no, I won't do that. Okay. And instead, I can't tell you yet, but it's the one that I'm working on at the moment.
We know who it is.
We figured it out. Yeah. It does sound that's very exciting. Because I was going to ask if you're working on something else. But cool.
Very early stages, because we decided on the subject, and then we went like no. And then now we're thinking, maybe. And I got a meeting on Monday with my editor and my agent, and we may just go for it. But meanwhile, you have to start conversations.
Of course.
And, which I've done. So nothing written, nothing. Maribel has got any notes yet. But
Very early stages.
Very early.
Cool. Well, we'll watch this space. Watch this space.
If you need titles, sound the conch.
That's the worst title I ever heard. Even the ones that we had.
Not if it's a comedy book.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Hey,
yeah.
Whoa, hang on. I only, this whole thing
it is Paul Konchesky.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, one last question I was going to ask, which was sent from Tash, who's normally on the show with us. She says, Guillaume, how do you pronounce your name in a Stoke accent without offending you? I think she was very concerned if she came on that she was going to mess
Stoke
it up.
Stoke accent. I can do Liverpool accent if I spend an hour a day, because that's where I learn my English.
Okay.
But Stoke accent, no idea.
Impossible. Impossible to do. That's the answer.
You will always offend him.
Yes.
Don't even try.
She's a very offensive person. Anyway, the book is out now. Maradona, the Boy, the Rebel, the God. It's amazing. It really is a great book. If you love football, if you love books, it really is a brilliant book. We all loved it. Make sure you go out and buy it. Thank you so much for coming on, Guillaume. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really has.
A pleasure. I really enjoyed the last 4 hours with you. Thank you.
Hey, it's not, our phone didn't explode. It's not our fault. Please, whoever you're writing the next book about, please do come on again when you've done that. And we'd love to chat to you about it. If you enjoy the show, do join the Football Book Club by heading to www.patreon.com/footballbookclub. There's loads more to catch up with on there. Anyone has any thoughts on this episode or any questions for us, follow us at Footy Book Club on Twitter, Football Book Club on Instagram, or on our Facebook page. We'll be back in a fortnight with the excellent comedian Maisie Adam, who'll be reading Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank's autobiography, Jimmy, with us. Guillaume, thank you. Any last words, anyone?
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, what a beautiful way to
so
end.
So sincere.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah. I really
thank
enjoyed
you
it.
So much. Much.
Us too. Guillaume. Us too. Thank you so much, Guillaume.
Bye-bye. Bye.
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 Thanks for listening to Football Book Club. It featured James Bug, Jack Bernhardt, James Balgen, and Guillaume Balaguer. It was produced and created by James Bug. The book, Maradona, the Boy, the Rebel, the God, is out now through Orion Publishing. Make sure you check it out. The theme music, Hills Behind, is the work of Silent Partner and is using a Creative Commons 4.0 license. We'll see you in a fortnight. Until then, bye-bye.